Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to The Powerful Patient. We're so glad to have you here today. This is really great. I'm Joyce Graff, and The Powerful Patient is a radio show that works with issues of interest to people with complex medical conditions and various kinds of disabilities. The primary community that I work with every day is people with von Hippel-Lindau disease, which is a hereditary cancer syndrome, and we bring this program to you to share the kinds of things that we've learned managing a complex medical condition over many years, keeping you as healthy as you can possibly be. All of our bodies have some likes and some dislikes and some special things about them that make them hum along a little bit better than others. But we're going to talk today about one thing that we all have in common. We all like to eat, and what we eat and how we eat and when we eat, all of that are important. But there's so much conflicting information out there in all the magazines and television shows and everything, all the people who would like to sell you their product, which may or may not be good for you, and so forth. So we're going to talk today with Haley Pomeroy, who is an expert in nutrition. He'll give us a few pointers. And before I bring Haley on, I wanted to play a little message for you about von Hippel-Lindau disease, and we would appreciate your support of this program and of the work that we do at VHL.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
Thanks for being with us, and don't forget to go to the Powerful Patient website. It's powerfulpatient.org, where you will find this show and also others that we've archived over many years. Haley, welcome.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yes, this is Haley Pomeroy, and you're a wellness counselor out in California, right?
Yes, I am.
So can you give us a little bit about your background so that we understand the perspective that you're bringing?
Absolutely. I've been practicing nutrition for the past 15 years now this spring, and I own integrative healthcare clinics, so our practices incorporate a variety of different natural modalities as well as some conventional medical diagnostics and things of that nature. I practice in Beverly Hills, California, Calabasas, California, Burbank, as well as I have a practice in Fort Collins, Colorado. My basis is kind of food as medicine and utilizing nutrition and natural therapies to enhance the environment that we call our bodies and, incorporating a variety of different things. We're fortunate enough to work and integrate with hospitals like Children's Hospital, Johns Hopkins, and things of that nature, as well as other ends of the spectrum, such as acupuncture and massage therapy and just a variety of different modalities that we can utilize or have access to help keep people healthy and help get people in a much healthier state if they're dealing with a particular disease or disease process.
Thank you. Yeah, that sounds terrific. And you said a couple of key words here, integrated healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
And integrated healthcare has become a kind of buzzword these days. Can you explain to us a little bit about what that means?
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting because when I started practicing about 15 years ago in the alternative healthcare community, as well as in the what they call the Western healthcare community, there was a big divide 15 years ago. There was a big kind of us or them. You were either practicing alternative medicine or you were practicing Western medicine, maybe drug therapies or things of that nature. Then I saw it kind of move into what they started using the verbiage a little more complementary medicine, meaning things that worked together or at least didn't interfere with one another. An individual that was maybe on a chemotherapeutic could complement with maybe a nutritional or complement their care with some change in diet. And then the movement kind of came, as I've watched it evolve over the 15 years, into more integrative, which means that there's actually a synergy that maybe utilizing a Western diagnostic can actually enhance a nutritional program. And on the other side, maybe utilizing a nutritional supplement or a nutritional food can actually enhance a drug therapy. So when I use the word integrative, I look that I'm open-minded to all different aspects of care as long as they are synergistic and that they enhance and get behind our goal for that particular patient.
Right. I read something the other day that Americans spend at least as much money on alternative or complementary medicines as they do on regular medicine. And when you add up what we spend on pharmaceuticals as well as doctor visits, that's a whole bunch of money. We're spending at least that much at the health food store. So we're doing it, whether we're admitting it to our doctors or not.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And as you say, in the past, you'd go to your regular doctor, and if you said the word acupuncture, you might get laughed out of the room.
Absolutely.
Or vitamins, even. And then it's begun to come a little bit closer together. And today, what you're indicating is that hopefully your Western medicine doctor would be working hand in glove with your acupuncturist or your nutritionist to try to treat you as a whole person.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm in my Burbank office, and we see about 300 patients a day over here, and I'm the naturalist on staff. And, you know, we have everything from breast diagnostic to cardiovascular. We have in-house labs. And I just have to say that, you know, doctors that are really on the cutting edge of medicine, and in my opinion, too, people that integrate natural therapies that are on the cutting edge of their field, they're really looking at ways to help the patient. And I'll say the movement, I would love to say that it's just because everybody suddenly decided to embrace natural therapies, but it's really the patients that drove that, one, by their dollar, by their purchasing power, by them making a statement with what they do buy as far as foods at the grocery store or supplements on the shelf. And the other is by not being afraid to walk into their doctor's office and say, you know, are you open to me trying this food or this nutraceutical before I go on maybe Crestor or Lexapro or some other pharmaceutical. So it's really the patients, in my opinion, have really driven this change, and it's a beautiful thing to see.
Right. Now, when I first became familiar with your work, it was through your work in infertility.
Mm-hmm.
So, and what I was really struck with was that your focus seemed to be on just supporting your body and being the best it can be at whatever the activity is. In the case of fertility, that's certainly one very important human function.
Absolutely. And as you know, I have a book called Craving Conception that was the first book that I had put out, and it was about nutrition for fertility and how to enhance things like sperm count and egg quality, how to actually evoke a change in the body as opposed to maybe just an overall sense of wellness, but where an individual was having a real quantitative struggle. And fertility is really, as you know, my mother is Dr. Wilson, and she specializes her practice as fertility, East-West Conception Center. Fertility is something that's always kind of been integrated into our family, near and dear to our heart. Our whole family works in that aspect of practice. But what's wonderful about it is the results that you see are, you know, I always say in the faces of our babies. It's not, do you kind of feel pregnant? Are you sort of having a better sperm count? It's definitely something that you can quantify. And so it really, to me, is one aspect. I also feel that way about, you know, things like cholesterol and cholesterol levels and triglycerides. It's one aspect where you can actually evoke a very powerful change and have, you know, not only a change in chemistry and a change in hormones, but you actually get a baby at the end. And so that's kind of it's a very exciting specialty to play in. All of the And that's an accessory function in the body. Being able to conceive is not, although on the emotional end it may feel like this for people, but it's not a medical necessity for our bodies, where the heart beating is a medical necessity, the liver functioning is a medical necessity. So it's what we call an accessory function. And so if the body is in a state where it can't do that, and we can enrich the body to the point where that can happen, it's a beautiful thing to see.
So in many ways, the body conserves its resources to do the primary stuff first, right?
Absolutely.
And so if your heart and lungs are not in good order, it could be that your conception was your ability to conceive was reduced on purpose to protect you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, unfortunately, in America, we're seeing so many bodies in survival mode. You know, they're retaining weight, their blood sugars are off, their triglycerides are off, and that's really a very smart body attempting to alter the chemistry so that it can survive.
Hmm. So this is a sign that there's a weakness that needs to be taken care of. It's a symptom.
Absolutely. I always say the body whispers, then it talks, then it yells, then it screams. And where we choose to listen and support is, you know, kind of our choice, but also what resources we have available to us.
Right. So there are a lot of people who come through the internet chat rooms and things like that looking for help, trying to get a diagnosis of some mysterious ailment. And I wonder how many of these might be subtle kinds of allergies or just simple reactions to different kinds of things in our environment or a food supply. How does one go about trying to figure out what your body's whispering to you about?
You know, there's a lot of different Western diagnostics like blood panels and labs. We use a lot of alternative diagnostics, we use non-cognitive biofeedback in our office. An EDS device is what they call it. We use Chinese diagnostic. We also use some of the non-conventional labs like Great Smokies, Meridian Valley, some of the urine tests, some of the saliva tests. There's some different quote-unquote diagnostics of that nature. The other thing that we do sometimes is we really assess the person's environment. As far as, I always say, if you're eating, breathing, drinking, sleeping, I think it's about 240 carcinogens we're exposed to every day just by doing those things, let alone if you have a job, a high-risk job, or you're consuming poor quality foods. Mm-hmm. So there's a variety of different diagnostics that you can do. We also, it's kind of funny, we have a, and I know you know, we do a kind of a cleanse protocol. We have like a 10 and a 30-day protocol. Sometimes we put people through that just to clean the slate, just to get the caffeine out, to get the dairy out, to get things kind of where we get a little bit more clear picture. I guess I should say that we take a little bit of the fog away. So sometimes we'll do that. But, you know, really when we sit down, and I on my website, I give a lot of suggestions around this, like, you know, maybe eliminate this for a week, maybe try this. We'll use pregnancy as an example. If you're having a recurrent miscarriage, have your doctor check for this. It's a particular lab that many doctors don't check for, but it's very common now in young women. With breast cancer, we were really proponents for doing a test that was called a FISH test, or Herceptin receptor positive test, that a lot of people weren't doing at first, especially in our young women with breast cancer. So there's a lot of different things that you can look at. I always think of it as a great mystery, and we're, you know, like Sherlock Holmes, and we're really trying to figure out what's the body saying and what does it mean. So in our clinic, we use a variety of different things. On the website, I have a lot of different kind of suggestions of if this, then that, you know, try this, try that.
Right. So where does one find a practice like your own? What keywords should you look for on the internet, or how could you find something in your particular geography?
Well, we have on our website, we have resources of individuals that we personally have relationships with, that we work with, and we feel pretty comfortable about those people. You can either go on to HaleyPomeroy.com, which is my website, mm-hmm. or you can go on to we have a supplement company that's EastWestEssentials.com. Both of those have resources pages, and what we try to do is connect with, you know, physicians, everything from, you know, OBGYNs to acupuncturists to that. I have some personal chefs on there, individuals that do cooking and delivery services, just a variety of things of individuals that we feel really good about working with.
Right.
Other than that, my biggest thing is make sure that the person sitting across from you is really, really listening to you. And every time you walk into your doctor's office, every time you walk into your practitioner's office, I always say reintroduce yourself and say something interesting or unusual about yourself. Because that, watching 300 patients come through our this Burbank office every day, and we have some of the brightest, most heartfelt doctors over here, but it's really hard to make sure that they understand your case when they have, you know, 10 minutes with you, right?
Right.
So that's my rule of thumb for patients is I always say introduce yourself and say something unique about them, about yourself.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, and walk in with a list of questions. Because when we talk in the lunchroom, people say, oh, yeah, that's right. That's the guy that races motorcycles. Or, oh, yeah, that's right. You know, so it really does help.
It helps to pin it to something.
Yeah, just a little insight.
It's not just a white sheet of paper like everybody else's.
Yes, and just from being on the other side of the spectrum, it really helps patients not slide through the cracks. I mean, there's a lot of other really good patient advocacy tips that I say, you know, walk in with every time you go to the doctors, you should have a minimum of 5 questions and make sure all 5 of those questions get answered. You know, I have some little advocacy tips, but my number one thing is introduce yourself, even though they've just looked at your chart, and say something interesting about yourself.
Yeah, diagnosis is not an easy quest. As you say, when this patient walks in, they could have anything of thousands of things that could be wrong with them, and it's up to the doctor to try to sift through all that and come down to it as efficiently as possible. But sometimes it's not an efficient process. And there are certain Western tests, as you say, but I think what I'm concerned about is that it's very difficult for most people to find a practitioner who will take that orderly nutritional perspective and do the hair analysis or whatever it takes, those other kinds of lab tests that the Western doctors will never recommend or very, very rarely would recommend. Mm-hmm. I came across something on the Internet just the other day. I had a friend coming over for dinner who has celiac disease, so I looked up, you know, how to cook for somebody with celiac disease. And one of the things that the information said was, if you suspect that you might have celiac disease, don't just self-diagnose and change your diet, because that can actually obscure some of the findings on the diagnostic tests.
Absolutely.
You really need to get a medical diagnosis first before you change your diet. So how does that all fit together? And how, any besides the names that are on your website, if somebody's in a geography that's not mentioned there, what aspects should they be looking for?
Absolutely. There's a couple different associations. ACAM is the American College for the Advancement in Medicine. They have an interesting website where they advocate, you know, they've just endorsed a lot of different IV nutritionals and a lot of therapies that IV chelation therapy for cardiovascular or diabetes. They have some good resources on their website as well, and it's, you know, all over the United States. You know, I'm a big advocate for chiropractors that integrate different wellness aspects. They seem to have a really good network as far as an industry. I would say, I'll have to tell you, in the nutritional industry, the network is very loose, and there is so many different ends of the spectrum. I mean, I have individuals that walk in here that have been with people that, you know, calorie count, which I don't do with my clients, or count, you know, sodium grams and believe in fat-free, which I'm not an advocate of, or believe in sugar-free, which I'm not an advocate of. So it's as far as an industry, it's a really loose-knit industry with a lot of, as you said earlier, varying philosophies. Naturopathic medicines, licensed naturopathic doctors have the state of California just recently licensed them as primary. They have a very good association in many states. Now, there's many states that they're not licensed, and so there are naturopathic doctors that, you know, can be phenomenal practitioners but maybe don't carry a license in the particular state that you're in. The acupuncture industry, and again in California, their license is primary care, so they have a lot, you know, they can send for an x-ray, they can send for a blood test, they have a lot bigger scope of practice, where in certain states they don't. But those are all great. I would love to tell you that there's a great nutritional association. There's not. I hope somebody hears this and decides to do one.
And it's regulated by the state, too, which means also that there's a wide variety of the way the states feel.
Yes,
should be
and there's no licensure in California. I mean, I'm in California, and there's no licensure for what I do. So it's really kind of an interesting, we're loosey-goosey out here for sure.
Right.
But it's you know, I really think that the practitioner, this is just my opinion, should give you a 10, you know, minute on the phone, 10 or 15 minute consultation for free. We do that, and I am a big advocate of that because I think that you guys need to make sure that you share common philosophies and that you can work together because it's a health commitment. It's, you know, I definitely, in my first appointment, my goal is that if they never see me again, that they walk out the door, and as well as on our website, that they have resources to really change their life, that they're there, that they're available. We put out so much free literature. We have wonderfully successful practices, and that's great, and it supports us and all of that, but I really have I have a big personal mission to make sure that people have access to the information to empower themselves. But I have clients that honestly I've worked with for 14 years, you know, that we've been through, you know, breast cancer and babies and all different aspects of their lives kind of working together. So I'm sorry, I wish I could give you, like I said, we try to have some resources. Those organizations that I personally respect and that they have very good resources.
That's great. That's great. Because I've looked for somebody around me, and there's such a forest, and it's very hard to do a kind of qualitative review of them also. So getting a
and
recommendation
personal
from a friend who knows someone is helpful. But then, it is pretty unregulated and a little difficult right now. Let's talk about the immune system, because I know you have some really good guidance on the immune system, because this is one of those essential functions. It's your primary defense against everything from the common cold on down. And how can we make sure that our immune system is working at its best for us?
Absolutely. I look at it in two ways. One, what you can put in to help enhance, to create fertile soil for the immune system. And two, what you don't want to put in because it can just, one, I mean, if we were very, very conservative in our verbiage and say it's going to at least, maybe it won't cause cancer like some of the studies are showing and things like that, but it's at least going to not help us out. It's going to at least trip us up a little bit or put a stress on our immune system. So I kind of look at it both what can you do and maybe what maybe you should consider not doing. And I don't know if you wanted me to talk to specifics on either one of those or...
Sure, that would be great.
Okay.
Yeah.
I kind of go through the just maybe two or three things that I would definitely be conservative about that are detrimental to the immune system. And the first one, and I know everybody's kind of harping on this, but refined sugars. And I go back to the study that I mentioned a lot about Stanford doing one teaspoon of refined sugar, cutting our T cell count, which is very important in the immune system, by 50% for a three-hour period after consumption.
So if you have just one teaspoon of sugar in your coffee, that they're finding is that that reduces the power of your immune system by half for the next 3 hours.
And the specifics in the study talked about T cells. So we have T cells and B cells, and T cells are kind of like, you know, in a layman's way to describe it, kind of the cells that go in and say, hey, look, there's a problem. They kind of flag the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so our
T cells are sometimes called the killer cells, but in this sense, it's a good thing because they go around and they find some cell that's not properly formed, and they say, you know what, why don't you just self-destruct and we'll make a new one?
Yeah, or even viral bacterial identification too. You know,
right.
Oh, good, that you know why you got exposed to the common cold and you got it and I didn't, or vice versa. So that's huge. And when we look at we're consuming 2 to 3 pounds of refined sugar as a society. Weekly, that's crazy, you know, and it's in our foods and it's available. And so I really
2 to 3 pounds a week. And that's usually not shoveled in your mouth as teaspoons of sugar. That's consumed in other more subtle ways that you may not even be thinking about. The most obvious of those is what? Soda pop, right?
Absolutely. Gatorade's another one that shocked people. 11 to 13 spoonfuls in each Gatorade that you consume.
Oh, my goodness, and that's one that everybody considers to be one of the more healthy ones.
Absolutely, and I have little kids, and on the soccer field, that's what everybody's drinking, you know, 2 and 3 of those in a game.
Wow, you can get a real sugar high.
It's amazing.
That.
Yeah, they can run so fast, and you know, but that's amazing. Also, sometimes in the breads that we eat, in the peanut butters that we choose, in the pasta sauces, that's a big one. The other one is ketchup. You know, we're in, and what you want to look is not necessarily the grams of sugar, because that can be also in a label that can be, you know, a fruit-based sugar or a dairy-based sugar, but you want to look for the word sugar in the ingredient list. And that's what I tell individuals. There's no business having sugar in your peanut butter.
Right, and one of those tips about reading a label is they have to put the ingredients in the order of quantity. So the highest quantity thing, like water, will be first, and then it'll be sugar or something like that. But here's a trick. In order not to put sugar in the number one or two position, they sometimes will break it up and have some refined sugar and some high fructose corn syrup and some other kinds of fructose or glucose, something or other.
Absolutely. You know, I had the privilege, my son and I, of attending the movie premiere of a movie that's out right now called Food, Inc. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's phenomenal. It's a really great movie because it doesn't sensationalize the issue, because it's a real easy issue to get behind.
Yes.
But it really brings to the attention. I was very impressed. It brings to the attention a lot of the hidden things that we have in our foods that say natural and healthy, and utilize those terms in our in their packaging and in their marketing, that really have some pretty heavy hitters in them. And so, you know, how do we stand a fighting chance? I was reading an article, and it was talking about salads at restaurants, and there's a particular very popular chain that has a salad on their healthy menu choice that's 2,700 calories. And just in the salad itself. So it's billed as in their healthy choices.
How did they get to 2,700 calories?
In a salad. I know. It's pretty sad. So
mayonnaise and cheese and...
Yeah, and they use trans fats when they bread their chicken. And I have on my website, I have the top 20 worst foods to eat out, and it's like some of them have 86 grams of fat in one serving. I mean, it's crazy when you think about
it.
Yeah, and so we don't really stand a fighting chance when we're out
but
there.
But in prepared foods, they tend to add sugars and fats because it adds the flavor.
Because you've got a low quality food. You've got a low quality, especially when you're talking chicken, especially when you're talking low quality chicken or low quality egg products. The taste is so much different that they have to add quite a few things to make it taste decent. So sugar, I always say, you know, the least you can consume, the better. It doesn't seem to have as much of an effect if it's raw organic sugar. I use things like, you know, to give you the other side, I use things with my clients like stevia. I use things like, there's a product called Way Low that you can purchase online.
W-A-Y-L-O-W?
It's W-H-E-Y.
W-H-E-Y. So that sounds like a milk product.
It is a derivative, absolutely. Stevia is leaf-based. I use coconut sugar a lot when I bake, especially. I have some recipes online for some phenomenal cookies, and I use coconut sugar. Sometimes I use sucranat, which is also a plant-derived sugar. Anything from the natural derivatives, xylitol can be okay with some people. It sounds chemical, but it's actually a naturally derived sugar. Some people prefer that. I use stevia a lot in coconut
sugar. Yeah, stevia is a chopped up leaf, right? It's a dried chopped up leaf, like an herb.
Yeah, and there's ones that are somewhat processed, though. I mean, there's more and more companies are using stevia extracts, so we do have some refinement going on there. But the glycemic value, the sugar value, is zero in it, so we don't have the same issue as we do with refined sugars. So it's a little bit of a different mechanism in the body. So definitely, there's so many phenomenal alternatives. I made cheesecake the other night. My father's diabetic, so I was very concerned about the glycemic value, and I used stevia in it and ricotta, and you know, just a whole different kind of way to go, and it was amazing. So there's a lot of alternatives. Yeah, and then I would say that from an immune system, that's probably one of the best things that you can do for yourself.
Okay. And what else should we stay away from?
You know, I'm not a proponent at all for caffeine, especially in our coffee. It's a very, very dirty. The chemical, especially in a non-organic coffee, the chemical exposure that we put ourselves through by there are many herbicides and pesticides that are completely illegal in the United States that we allow to be transported down into our coffee fields, and then we allow the product back up. So it's that my three dirtiest, as far as from a chemical perspective, are coffee, iceberg lettuce, oranges, and then grapes are pretty high up there too. As far as
oranges.
That. Yeah, very
that's interesting.
Yeah, and especially with oranges, the non-organic oranges, even more so with all of our weather changes, especially in the Florida region, we've mm-hmm. used a lot of different fungicides that seem to really have residue that we weren't even using. What I've noticed, we weren't even using those 7 years ago. So.
You know, one of the things I've noticed lately about oranges, and I was in a cafe with some other women the other day, and they had on the menu fresh-squeezed orange juice, and one of my friends ordered a large fresh-squeezed orange juice, and I thought to myself, how many oranges are in that glass? You know, that we've mm-hmm. gotten so far away from it. It comes now in a half-gallon container, and you can pour yourself a 12-ounce glass. Mm-hmm. But that's a lot of calories,
a lot of sugar. Yes.
And as a matter of fact, somebody, I read somewhere that they've been dumping a certain amount of the waste products from the orange production into the waters in Florida, and some of the crocodiles are getting diabetes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I also think that if you read, there's quite a bit of literature on that right now, too. They're also talking about that it's changing the foliage so much. Because of that practice as well. And I think that's, some of the fungicides that weren't legal when we had a lot of our hurricane seasons down there, we had a lot of damage, and a lot of lobbyists came in and said, look, if we don't use these products, we're going to lose all of our citrus. And so a lot of things right now are even being allowed to be used just temporarily. We'll see if they stay. But where our government said, no, they're not safe, and they said, well, maybe we'll let you use them now because we'd hate to lose all the crops. So it's a real, oranges, I'm a foodie, you know, I read about all these things, but if you just follow oranges, and the other one is iceberg lettuce, that's a kind of a fascinating story as far as, you know, they talk about individuals that pick iceberg lettuce and their tumors growth, and that it's just so heavily, heavily treated. And my other one, which is an interesting fact, is enriched flour. If you're buying any mm-hmm. grain product, enriched flour, they did this really cool study where they showed bugs, you know, that typically grow in grain and grain mills, and they put them in vats of just enriched flour, no whole grain kernel, and they died. They died within 3 days. And so it was really
not even enough nutrition for a wheat
there's
weevil.
Not even exactly. And I thought that was just fascinating. It's and they repeated it over and over and over again. And one of the, and, you know, we use enriched flours for a lot of reasons in the industrialization of our food. One was, you know, so that they could sell all the nutrients to you in a supplement form, right? As they pull them out, they could put them on the next shelf, the next aisle over, and get your money twice. But the other two was really because it was a big deterrent for, well, it's cheap, but also it was a big deterrent they found for bugs and rotting. And, you know, that's why if you buy a piece of Ezekiel bread, it's going to turn green and furry on your counter a lot faster than a piece of, you know, a product that has a lot of enriched flour in it.
Right. But, of course, we have other ways of refrigerating things these days. I buy a loaf of bread, and I throw it almost immediately in the freezer.
I do, too. And I pick
and
a couple
I just
pieces
take it
off
out and
toast
it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
So I tell my clients all the time.
So I can keep a loaf of bread going for 2 weeks and not
Absolutely.
Feel guilty about it because it's not turning green and furry, as you say. But you're right. If the things, one of the reasons that we do get the longer shelf life these days is because of all these treatments. But the treatments are not always so great for us as we eat them.
No. I mean, if you think about, like, I always talk about nitrites in your meat. They help the meat, one, retain water. The other is they block fat metabolism so the fats don't go rancid. Well, you're consuming that.
So now
and so you're
going to
retain
water,
and you're not going to break fat down. I mean, You know, if it does it to live, you know, we can't totally remove ourselves from the animal kingdom and say, well, it can have that effect on a turkey, but it just can't have that effect on me. You know, or
yeah.
I mean, it's just interesting how we've, and especially in the pork industry. I mean, and that's why what is the most, the ones that have the highest nitrates are in pork.
Yeah.
And you know, that's an interesting, and some of the products in our pork also, just like the oranges, got passed. There was a year in production where the pork industry lost, I think it was like $85 million, there's a bunch of zeros at the end, because of a stress factor that happened in pork. They called it PSE, pale, soft, and exudative, and all the pork started losing its water binding capacity. And anyway, there were quite a few chemicals that came into the pork industry during that process because they went, oh my goodness, we're going to lose, you know, we're going to lose this huge piece of farming. It's just like,
So if the pig retains water, that makes it heavier, and therefore my 20-pound pig, in fact, weighs 25 pounds, and I can get more money for it because I'm selling an extra 5 pounds. Is that the idea?
Absolutely. And when you think about from the farming industry, when you think about the fact that these prices are set and it's not based on quality, and they're set now by our federal government. I mean, USDF, it's a real interesting, I always say the closer you can get from pulling it off a tree, picking it out of the ground, or I patting the farmer on the back that just did it for you, the farmers markets, things like that, the much higher quality and less adulterated food we're going to have our hands on.
Wonderful. Yeah, and that's not always so easy because even the words natural and so forth are getting co-opted in the markets. So you can't trust all the organic and natural labels. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Absolutely. Well, what's funny to me is that, you know, I practiced for 15 years, and 10 years ago, as a society, we thought I didn't. I was always beating, you know, I grew up a little differently. I raised pigs and cattle and took, you know, animal science courses and things of that nature. So I have a little different background from there. But people thought I'm healthy. I'm doing Diet Cokes and Lean Cuisines. Sorry to use brands, but you know that was the movement where people were going to fat-free and sugar-free, and Diet Coke was the rage, and healthy choice or Lean Cuisine, you know, frozen dinners where, you know, you were sophisticated when you had a microwave and you could nuke your food, and you know, it's really, really been a wild ride to see over the last 15 years just the change in what's deemed healthy now. I mean, you know, Whole Foods, yes, was around 15 years ago, but there wasn't the surgence by any stretch of the imagination of people going in. And at Whole Foods, I get that the produce guy at the Whole Foods that I go to sometimes always sees me coming because I get so frustrated with him because I say, I can't tell the difference between your organics and conventional, and why is your conventional so expensive? And we go round and round, and, you know, it's kind of I send clients over, and I have to go and check out the stores, and we have private shoppers that shop for a lot of our clients and things of that nature. So, you know, but to you know, speak to that is that you, the closer to real food, the quicker it spoils. It's a great rule of thumb.
Yeah.
When people say to me, oh my gosh, I hate buying those because they spoil, I say that, you know what? It means you're buying the right thing. You just forgot to put it in your mouth because it won't.
Sometimes means we need to go more frequently to the grocery
store. Absolutely, yeah. And I do a lot of, like, I have grocery lists up on my website and stuff. I do a lot of where I help people. If, like, I have a chicken soup recipe. I have a chili recipe that's both, I have a vegetarian version. I always try to do a vegetarian version of everything. And I put a grocery list with it. Like, this is what you need if this is what you're going to make. And it really, it's really interesting because, and you got staples in the house that maybe you need, but in other countries, and if individuals get out and travel into other countries, you see that people go down to the market, to outdoor markets, and to the market sometimes several times in a week.
Right. I mean, a refrigerator for a family of four in Europe might well be underneath the counter.
Where here, if you don't have one in your garage so that you can put all your Costco stuff in, I mean, right. You know, you're not keeping up with the Joneses. No,
absolutely.
It's amazing.
When I was in Europe in 1967, one of my friends was going to visit a friend of hers who was like an 80-year-old woman, and she lived in a third-floor walk-up in Paris. And her son wanted to buy her a refrigerator. She said, "Mother, you know, you shouldn't have to go to the grocery store every day." And she said, "Please don't buy me a refrigerator," because it was part of her exercise and her social life to get herself up and get dressed and put her hat on and go to the market every day.
Well,
so
we have,
it is part of our society, what we are willing to do and what we are, you know, we'll go to the club, but we won't go to the grocery store three times a week. Maybe you can shift that a little bit.
Yeah, and it's interesting because we have a garden, and I put a garden into my kids' school as well, and it is so the kids get so excited as I'm preparing dinner, and I'll say, and you know, I live in Southern California. I'm in LA area, but it, you know, and so our friends always kind of crack up because I'll say, "Hey, why don't you run out and decide what vegetables we're going to have for dinner? Go pick us something," and they get, first of all, so excited to do it, and also it's so, you know, so encouraging for them to understand the process of, you know, from seed to plate, but also it motivates them to want to eat that, and I feel good about that. It's a very nutrient dense, and believe me, we don't by any stretch of the imagination grow all of our vegetables, but it's a process that I in the kids' class when my daughter was in kindergarten, when we first put in the garden, I grew Brussels sprouts because they're so fun to see. They grow on these real tall stalks. And then we chopped them up and I brought a cook stove in and we cooked them in class. And I had, like, all the kids in kindergarten were eating Brussels sprouts. Now, that's just not common anymore. But they had grown them. They had picked them. They had chopped them. You know, so it's, and I had so many parents, and I talked to so many people. Again, we're in Southern California. We're a little, you know, far removed from the farm for sure out here. Those kids had no idea. They had no idea that, and most of the parents, how Brussels sprouts even grew. You know?
I know.
So,
one of my son's friends was over one time, and I said, "Well, let's go pick some strawberries in our backyard for dinner." And they go, "Oh, you can't eat those. They're from the yard." I said, "Well, where do you think strawberries come from anyway?" And she said, "From the grocery store."
No, this is a funny story. My sister's going to kill me, but we have had chickens, and I love the eggs. And my sister will not eat the eggs from our chickens. She just won't. And I said, "Oh my gosh, they're fed organic food. They're, you know, they both have names. They're the sweetest things in the world. Why won't you eat the chickens?" And she says, "Because of where they come from." And I said, "Well, where do you think they come from at the grocery store? Brown cartons. That's all I care about." You know, so I think it's interesting. And I mean, all these people that I speak about are very, you know, educated. You know, we're fortunate. We have, you know, resources to eat healthier foods that are maybe more expensive or things of that nature, but it's really tough. It's, you know, our society's changing. It's evolved so much in the last 15 years. It's become, you know, okay, but I travel to, I also live in Southern California and Colorado, which is also very outdoorsy and things of that nature. I have spent time in places like, you know, Louisiana. I was in college in North Carolina where sweet tea and fried shrimp is norm.
Yeah,
and so, and not in every aspect, but in a lot of areas, we get fruits and vegetables here. I will never forget making dinner for people in North Carolina, and I had avocados and artichokes, and they had never ever seen either one of those in their life. And I thought, what? But it's true.
Right.
But I have my studio execs here in California that have never hard boiled an egg in their life either.
Right.
So I guess it's all ends of the spectrum. You just, I just try to make things, you know, and what I do with a lot of clients is I say, "Tell me what you're doing now." And then I look for ways to enhance that if they're going to put something in their mouth, that it's something that's actually going to give them value and not take away.
Sounds like good advice. I have a couple more questions for you,
Absolutely.
And I just wanted to remind our listeners, too, that if they want to put questions into the chat or raise their hand if they're called in, that we'll be glad to take a couple questions over the air. Could you talk a little bit about soy? What are the pros and cons around soy are getting to be almost as heated as high fructose corn syrup?
Yeah.
So, you know, what's good about soy and what's not so great about soy?
A lot of our soy is, we have a lot of genetically modified soy. I actually, you know, had done a lot of reading about soy and a lot of hem-hawing around about taking a position on that. One, because of in the fertility aspect, we've got the definitely the estrogenic effects. We've also got, you know, now they're coming out and saying soy blocks, you know, zinc absorption. It can cause prostate problems. Clinically, I definitely see midsection weight gain in men. It can definitely be a promote insulin resistance.
So soy has a number of plant-based natural estrogen,
absolutely,
which is that female hormone. And so if men get it, it tends to make them belly paunch and has some fertility issues associated with it. And with women, it's increased risk of breast cancer? And
you know, there's some debate there. You know, there's a lot of the doctors are saying that it being a phytoestrogen, it doesn't have the ability to have the same receptor sites as the estrogens that we have in our body.
Mm-hmm.
But then on the other end of the spectrum, they say that, yes, but it does interfere with cancer protective hormones. So the verdict's really out. I don't think that, especially in an isolate form, I don't think that it's a good source of protein. I think that if it's closer to the bean and it's non-genetically modified, like edamame, I think that that can be, in moderation, a very good nutrient form. But I don't. Tempeh seems to be another one that can be tolerated much more. Because of the form that the soybean is in. But, you know, gosh, even in our almond milks, I don't know, you know, there's a lot of almond milks out there that have a soy isolate in it, or a lot of our protein bars have a soy isolate in it. And too much of that I'm not an advocate for.
So when they add soy protein as a way of adding protein inexpensively into prepared foods, that's the part that is not so great.
And it has a real creamy texture to it. So it's probably better than some of the stuff they used to put in, maybe, you know. But I usually tell individuals to make sure that you're, you know, if you're using a vegetable or vegetarian based protein, that no more than 20% of your daily vegetable-based protein comes from a soy. And if an individual has breast cancer, or an individual is dealing with infertility, or an individual, especially men, are trying to lose midsection weight gain, I pull it out pretty much altogether. Again, edamame, tempeh, those might be some things, and certain forms of tofu that are non-genetically modified might be something that I say, you know, let's look at your protein, your vegetable-based protein, and let's make sure that none of that, no more than 20% of that's coming from a soy base. But to use it as a supplement, I'm not a big advocate.
Okay. Now, gluten. And, you know, we almost never used to hear about gluten, except that I remember Julia Child saying, well, the gluten content of European flour is different from American flour, and that's why it's harder to make a good crust on a French bread with American flour. But other than that, never even heard about gluten. Now it seems that everybody's sensitive to gluten. So what happened and what's going on?
Well, there's a couple things that have happened. Is one, that we've actually changed the grain itself and the gluten content in our grains. And so I think that the hybridization of the grain, we're not eating the same thing that we used to be eating, for one thing. The other thing is, I think that with a lot of the additional additives and preservatives, I mean, when you look at the fact that a lot of non-organic chicken is not only raised on antibiotics, but during the processing, they spray it with antibiotics. I mean, our antibiotic consumptions, you think
what?
You all, oh yeah, you think, well, I'm not taking antibiotics, I'm not taking, and we, so we have an overgrowth of yeast and a dysbiosis or an imbalance of bacteria in the gut. We are, and everybody went to the, you know, they go through McDonald's now and they buy the chicken sandwich instead of the beef, right? but you've got to think about what we're having exposure to. And I think what it's done to our GI tract. So I think there's a combination. I think, one, that our GI tracts have really been assaulted by overuse of broad-spectrum antibiotics. I think also the chemical exposures that we've had, our terrain, our ecosystem in the gut is so off, is so out of balance, that I think that any insult is going to be a larger insult because the terrain is so fragile. So I think you've got, in my opinion, with the and there's definitely a surge, and there's a surge in celiac diagnosis. And not only, I don't think it's just because more doctors are checking for it. I think that we have a higher incidence in it. But, you know, we've got gluten sensitivity in populations like autism, autistic children. We've got gluten sensitivity in individuals. I see it a lot in women that are going through menopause. And the other large population is kids with acne. And especially if I see one more 12, 13-year-old walking in my office with stretch marks, young girls that have stretch marks, or finding that their bodies in the small intestine aren't absorbing a lot of the nutrients, or they're doing sodas that are robbing them of the nutrients as they go through growth patterns. Their skin is literally ripping, between 10 and 13, I have clients that are walking in the door going, and these children aren't. I mean, yes, we have a huge childhood obesity issue, but these are kids that aren't even obese.
For heaven's sake.
Yeah.
And their skin just lost its elasticity at that age.
Yeah, and a lot of that is because the gut is so disrupted. And I'm a huge, you know, I'm sitting in my Burbank office right now, and I am constantly beating the drums. I'm just so, antibiotics need to be used so much more conservatively than they're used. And I will say in the 15 years, I am seeing the pendulum swing. I get patients that walk out of here that are mad because the doctor didn't give them an antibiotic or didn't give their kid an antibiotic. He said to wait a week. He was, you know, so I'm definitely seeing doctors being more and more resistant to giving them out, some, giving them out like candy.
Yeah.
But, you know, even if you got a great doctor that says, why don't you go home and get some rest and drink lots of fluids, you know, 97% of ear infections are viral. You get a great doctor that says that about your child, you know, they need to stay home. We all need to stay home. You still are having that exposure when they're eating, you know, non-organic chickens, when they're eating,
right.
And even you can go to the natural, I don't even know if I want to say that brand, but there are some companies now that are doing natural chickens, and what that means is that 30 days prior to processing, there's no antibiotic usage, and there's no antibiotic usage during processing.
Which is at least a help, but
it's
not solving the problem. So, but they're spraying it with antibiotics. This, I presume, is to keep down the possibility that there's going to be botulism or other infections.
Salmonella, E. coli, absolutely. Yeah,
yeah,
and chicken's the worst. I mean, people, so interesting, I have people that come in that have a variety of different health issues, and on their thing they say, I'm allergic to the penicillins. And I say, well, do you eat non-organic chicken? And they just have that low-grade chronic exposure, and they wonder why they've got, you know, high rheumatoid factors or things like that. It's just a real area of suspect for me.
Right, so that if you have any sensitivity to penicillin or other antibiotics like that, you need to look at what's being done to your food supply.
Absolutely.
Goodness
Absolutely.
Gracious.
Yeah, so, you know, you hate to be doom and gloom, right? I always say if you're going to spend the money on organics, the higher up the food chain is where you need to focus your energy.
Right.
Meaning, you know, and dairy because of the nature of where dairy comes from, from the mammary gland, or also eggs in the ovaries. Those are an area that hormones conjugate. So if the animals are being treated hormonally, that those are great areas to go from. And if I look at the meats.
So you may be getting a double load of hormones from eggs or meat, milk, because of these extra treatments.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
So it's not just the normal hormone levels that you would expect in those. You're actually getting a lot more.
Absolutely.
Wow.
And, you know, there's individuals that even organic milk, they're not advocates of it because of the hormone levels even in non-organic milk. I mean, excuse me, in organic milk. So there's a whole, you know, interesting aspect there.
Right. I mean, there is a natural hormone level in those in those things.
But they have studies where they show male children that are given a milk-based formula, are given milk at too early of an age, can lactate.
Oh, so they'll actually have milk coming out their
You can actually express breast milk, yes, which is not uncommon when you're nursing. Yeah, but that's not uncommon when you're nursing. when you're nursing a male child, you can express breast milk. This is a very interesting subject. I'm sorry, but
no,
they're showing that they're showing that children, and especially with the non-organic dairies, that they're showing male children 3 to 6 months you can express breast milk.
Oh, for heaven's sake!
Yeah. So again, you have to kind of go and we're
so
supposed to have.
So our bodies are getting mixed up here because that's not the way things are supposed to go.
Absolutely.
And if these organs are being used in a way that's not intended, then things can go wrong. Other kinds of disease process can get kicked off.
Mm-hmm. So, lots of fruits and vegetables, organic meats and dairies, and, cut out the sugar and cut out the caffeine. If you could pull that off, you're really setting yourself up for a lot of health success.
So changing your diet, though, is hard. And I know when I was talking with Dr. Wilson, she was saying that the thing that people are most resistant to is giving up soda pop.
Mm-hmm. Or coffee.
Or soda pop or coffee, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But do you have any hints for people on how to modify their diet in a way that they're likely to stick with it?
Yeah, the biggest thing that I tell my clients is let's find things that you really, really like, and let's find healthy versions of those and make sure that those are integrated every single day. So that you don't feel deprived. I have a tendency to like fatty foods. I that's just kind of what I migrate more towards. So I make sure that I do lots of the nuts and seeds and lots of avocados and lots of nut butters because that's very satisfying to me. I have clients that like spicy or clients that like sweet. So we make sure that we really do a lot of fruits with those individuals so that we keep their blood sugar level high so they don't crave the sweets.
Because refined sugar is not the only way to get sweet, so you can have some of these other ones that we were talking about. And what is it? There's honey and
agave nectar.
Agave nectar.
Yeah, agave nectar is wonderful. I make oatmeal, and I have a little recipe for oatmeal with my clients, and we'll use agave nectar, and we use either berries or sliced apples and cinnamon. And sometimes we'll put, it depends on what we're trying to do, sometimes we'll put a little bit of Greek yogurt or a little bit of cottage cheese in there to make it really creamy. It's just wonderful. Mm. There's definitely, like I said, healthier alternatives to sweetening things up. But as far as the sodas and the coffees, you just have to pick your poisons. It's just not it's not doing anything to enhance your health. That's for darn sure, right?
I've often thought, instead of taking Coca-Cola and subtracting the caffeine and taking out the sugar, why don't you just start with water and add a little lemon juice,
Yeah, I always think, I don't want the knowledge that I have gleaned off of amazingly wonderful people after all these years, I like to share it, I have a whole thing for tea recipes, and where I make Arnold Palmer's or lemonade, or I made the most amazing sun tea this weekend that you can sweeten with stevia or agave nectar, and it's really, really good, and some are specific for hydration, and some are specific to kind of help the bowel, and some are if you've got a little cold or things like that. So those are options for sure. Sodas, Gatorades, they're just not conducive to being healthy. If you want to put them in, then you have to kind of look at it like, I always try to take out the emotionality of it, say, okay, let's look at it from a financial perspective. If you want to spend money on, we all have a choice. If you want to spend money on one thing, then it's going to take from another. And so you might have to say, okay, I really want to spend money on that, $400 pair of shoes. So I'm going to have to save, and I'm going to have to really think about how I'm going to support that decision. So I always tell people, if you're going to have a cup of coffee, let's use coffee as an example, make sure that you've had a good 10 to 20 grams of protein before you consume that coffee, because coffee is going to push the adrenal glands. That's why you get the buzz, the energy buzz from it. It's going to push the adrenal glands. And there's kind of, again, I'm basic making it a little basic, but the adrenal glands can either produce the fight and flight hormones, or they can produce a hormone called aldosterone, a little more sustained energy hormone. And in order to go more towards the aldosterone, more the good hormones from the adrenals, you need protein on board.
Sounds
and so
great. We're going to run out of time here in just a minute, so I just wanted to remind everybody to be sure to go to powerfulpatient.org. We'll have a handout there which will have the correct spelling of Haley Pomeroy's website and the various other things that we've mentioned. And we really want to thank you so much, Haley, for being with us today. As usual, you're always wonderful. And so thank everybody for being with us. And we hope that you will take to heart some of this good advice. And as Haley says, it's not about feeling deprived. It's not about just giving up. It's about giving your body the good stuff so that it won't continue to crave all the other things that may not be so wonderful for you. So I hope everybody has a great week. And be well and be a powerful patient. Haley, thanks again.
Thank you so much.
All right. Take good care, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.